With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Fall is all about cozy comforts, but when you're prioritizing your health, it's easy to feel like you're missing out. With Hero Bread, you can enjoy all your fall favorites because they're made with Hero Bread sliced bread loaves, tortillas, bagels, dinner rolls, and more. Try their all-new Hero Noodles with 12 grams of protein and just 80 calories. So skip replacing every carb with cauliflower and indulge in your breakfast, lunch, and dinnertime favorites while still hitting your goals. From breakfast bagels and meal-prepped enchiladas to mouth-watering burgers and cheesy noodles, you won't believe Hero Bread's options have 0 to 5 grams net carbs and are high fiber from the taste and texture. They've even got small batch drops of indulgent favorites like the popular Hero Croissant. And right now, Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code FALL25 at checkout. That's FALL25 at HERO.CO. All figures are per serving of Hero Bread. Contains 2 to 18 grams of fat per serving. See the product nutrition panels on Hero.co for more information.
You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Mr. Brennan can't have it both ways. He can't say, yes, I need to address the 227 timestamp, and then deny me the ability to cross-examine fully on this expert's methodology and to impeach her and to get at her reliability and her competence, which is a key issue of crossing an expert. Her competence has been determined in this decision, and it is her, because it was her report that was the basis for the court to not allow her to testify. They can't have it both ways. You can't say, I need to do it in direct, but no, I want to handcuff the defense on cross-examination. Now to answer your question, Your Honor. We are going to have a witness that is going to address the 227 issue. Okay. Whether it's Mr. Green or somebody else, we haven't determined. My point on that, Your Honor, is we shouldn't be limited in our cross-examination of the Commonwealth.
No, I'm just thinking it in terms of whether this might be appropriate for rebuttal. Well, that's...
Yeah. And Your Honor, my point would be that's obviously going to be Your Honor's decision ultimately. But again, the Commonwealth can't have it both ways. They're the ones who are triggering this issue. And I say triggering in a legal sense. They are putting at issue the 227 timestamp with this issue, with this witness. If they weren't doing that, I wouldn't be having this discussion at all. But they're putting it at issue. I have the right, respectfully, to cross-examine on the issue that they're putting in issue, and they shouldn't get rewarded with sort of having a pre-authorization of rebuttal to deal with it. They should have to meet their burden of rebuttal depending upon when the evidence comes. But I don't believe just because we may call a witness, that should dilute my ability to cross-examine this witness on an issue they're raising. I'm not
so
raising it.
You can see why I wish I had more notice on this, right?
Your Honor, I have no good answer for that.
So I will do what I can in the next half hour. I might need more time on this, frankly. But we'll see. She's here?
Your Honor, may I ask one thing? I just
want to know, is she here?
She is, Your Honor.
Can she stay another day if need be?
I think she'll do what the court directs her to do. She would have to leave by Friday. She cannot be here. Well, may I approach?
Yeah, why don't you come up?
That's your cooking copies for evidence.
Enter your part.
participant, please enter the You have joined the meeting as an attendee and will be muted throughout the meeting.
Please be seated. Court is in session.
The host would like you to unmute your microphone. You can...
All right. I appreciate the time. I appreciate people's patience. So, in reviewing the rules, I look at Rule 2. So, Mass Rule of Criminal Procedure, Rule 2, Purpose and Construction. And so, upon reflection and consideration, it says, these rules are intended to provide for the just determination of every criminal proceeding. They shall be construed to secure simplicity in procedure, fairness in administration, and the elimination of expense and delay. Also looking to Commonwealth versus Durand, I don't have the site. I know it's from 2016, 2017, a judge, Robert Kane was the trial judge. So because none of the purposes here in Rule 2 are served by the admission of the Maryland trial judge's decision, particularly were offered without notice to the court previously, I'm excluding that decision. Your rights are saved, Mr. Alessi. We've got that decision marked for identification, and you certainly are free to cross-examine Ms. Hyde regarding her methodology. So that's my decision. So bring the jurors in, please.
You are unmuted.
Chrissy, do you want this under that?
No.
Session in ABC.
All right. Jurors, I appreciate your patience. So, your next witness, Mr. Brennan.
The Commonwealth calls Jessica Hyde.
So the evidence given to the court and jury in the case now and here, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God.
Yes, I do.
Sorry.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good
morning, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Brennan, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Could you please introduce yourself to the jury and spell your last name for the record?
My name is Jessica Hyde, J-E-S-S-I-C-A, space H-Y-D-E.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a digital forensics examiner. I'm also an associate. I'm also an adjunct professor at George Mason University, where I teach mobile device forensics in their graduate program. I also own a digital forensics company that does training, services, and research.
In addition to teaching at Georgetown University, do you teach in other ways?
Correction, I teach at George Mason University, Georgetown. But thank you. I also teach, my company writes and develops training courses. I teach a mobile forensic analysis course and a data structures course there to law enforcement, civilians, etc.
Do you engage in any other type of academics or research?
I do. I do other research as part of some volunteer activities I do in the digital forensics field. So I'm the chair of DFIR Review, which is a body that reviews practitioner-created research so that it can go through peer review. I often do reviews as a member of a reviewer for Forensic Science International Digital Investigations Journal, which I was a previous associate editor of.
What does peer review...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
What does peer review mean?
Peer review means that when a study is done or a research paper is done on a topic, that an assessment is done of it. There are three types of assessments that can be done. One is a methodological assessment, where you read through the methodology of the academic or practitioner-created paper and state if it is acceptable or not. The second is you conduct your own testing using the same methodology to conduct a peer review with your own generated data sets. And the third is if the original author has shared their data sets, reviewing their data sets and checking that against their work.
Has any of your work been peer-reviewed in the past?
I've had two peer-reviewed journals. I've had an article that was peer-reviewed and published in Forensic Science International Digital Investigations regarding the standardization of file classification of recovered items. The layman's term of that would be talking about what deleted means. And then I have another paper that's been accepted that I was a co-author on in terms of timelines and correlations of forensic evidence.
You mentioned you work in forensic data analysis. Generally, what does that mean?
It means that I look at evidence of digital forensics devices, be them mobile phones, computers, Internet of Things devices, and do analysis to provide meaning and context to the data that's recovered from them, as well as performing data recovery of those same computer-related devices.
Did you have any specific education or training to learn about forensic data?
Absolutely. I have professional training both from courses I've taken, as well as I have a master's in digital forensics from George Mason University. A master's degree in that. I've taken multiple courses, advanced mobile analysis, iOS forensics courses from SANS, computer forensics courses from SANS. I have multiple certifications. I hold the GIAC GCFE, which is the GIAC Certified Forensics Examiner. I also hold the NWC 3 CFE, which is a certified forensics examiner.
Do you, through your company, teach other forensic examiners how to study forensic data?
Correct. I teach government agencies, both federal and state and local, how to do digital forensic analysis, as well as private sector digital forensics examiners.
How do you teach private digital forensic examiners? What's the method?
I've developed an online virtual course that we teach virtual live, so I'm always there when I'm teaching, but I also have a team of instructors. So for example, the mobile forensic analysis course that I developed right now this week is being taught to a police department in Texas right this moment.
Forensic data analysis seems like a broad field. Is there certain parts that you focus in?
I personally specialize in mobile phones and Internet of Things devices.
I want you to just give us some very basic, very general and brief background. When you're looking at a forensic device and you're analyzing it, do you rely on any tools?
That is a really interesting question. Reliance on tools is not precisely what we do. We utilize tools to extract data from a device, and then we utilize a variety of tools to attempt to parse results from those devices. But the forensics examiner has to take the additional step to both understand, validate, and provide meaning to those results.
Is there any shortcomings or dangers in simply relying on a forensic tool for a result or an opinion?
There is absolutely a danger in just relying on parsed results. When an algorithm is used to determine what data is stored as, it doesn't tell you what that data means, and that's where you need a forensics examiner. Tools don't necessarily understand how the data got there and what causes the data to exist, and that takes deeper and further human analysis, as well as, you know, if you think about it, if on your phone you can go to the Google Play Store or the App Store, and you can actually download millions of apps. There's like 6 million apps between the two stores. Digital forensics tools maybe support generously 1,000 applications. So in order to be able to parse and understand the data from applications that the tools don't know how to support, you need a forensics examiner who knows how to dig into that data, conduct testing, and determine the meaning of the data.
Were you asked by the Norfolk County District Attorney's Office to look at and analyze a phone that was related to a person by the name of Jennifer McCabe?
Yes, with a very, very specific scope to a specific date range.
Were you asked during that scope and date range to analyze it and provide an opinion about whether there were any user-initiated deletions of any web searches or Safari-type searches?
Yes, I was asked to look for deletions of Safari searches within the scope of the time frame that was dictated by the purpose of the exam.
Were you asked to look at the phone device and determine whether or not there were any user-initiated deletions of phone calls on the device?
Yes, I was asked to look for deletions of phone calls in that same date range.
And did you do both of those tasks?
Yes, that's correct.
Did you ultimately have opinions on both of those issues?
I do have opinions on both of those issues. That's correct.
And in engaging in the efforts to answer those two questions, did you necessarily have to review and analyze a web history that included searches on January 29th, 2022 at 2:27 a.m.?
I did analyze web searches that occurred at 2:29 a.m. on local time here in Norfolk on January 29th, 2022 from the device that was provided, yes. Not the device, the forensic image, for clarity.
So before we get to the two opinions that you were asked to consider or what your opinions were after analyzing the data, I want to begin by giving the background and having you share with us your analysis and your observations and opinions about the search on Safari relative to this 2:27 time frame. Before we begin that, let me just ask you one question. Did you do anything to ensure the integrity of the data that you were looking at?
Upon receiving the forensic image, the first thing I did was I did what's called a hash of the image. So a hash is an algorithmic representation of a file. So a forensic image, all the data from the phone, it comes in one file that can then be extracted and have the rest of the data. That singular file that's received, there's actually three, but focusing on the one that has all of the data, that archive file, you can run what's called a hash algorithm against it. There's actually multiple hash algorithms. And I hashed it, and then I validated that hash to the document that was provided along with the image file that contained the hashes that were contained in. Those hash values matched. Now, just for clarity, if you change one bit in a file, it will not have the same hash. So the hash provides integrity, and having used both hashes, which are available in that report, and ran two different algorithms, they both matched. Additionally, I reviewed the PDF that was received for signs of alteration. The PDF that comes with a Great Key report is not signed by Adobe Acrobat. However, I was able to take that PDF and then examine it just like I would a phone. So I'm using the same techniques on the phone. Using a tool called EXIF tool, I was able to learn a lot about the creation of that particular PDF. And what I was able to learn about it was that it was created by, it's labeled it as being produced by Grayshift using a particular code-based application to create the PDF called PYF PDF, standing for Python Framework PDF. It is on, it's a program that you can download, and developers who create tools like Magnet Forensics, who owns the Gray Key, utilize that script, which is why it says it's produced by it, to create the actual PDF. That's what the evidence there in the data tells me. It also contains a time of when that is created, and that time was February 2nd, 2022, at global UTC, that's the global constant time, think what's in the UK, at 22:49, which local time would be 5:49 p.m. So that says that it was created approximately 2 hours and 45 minutes after the document said the image started, and it correlated with the document information. So that provided some level of certainty that that document was factual, and on top of that, I further opened the file of that PDF in what's called a hex editor, which lets me see like every byte, every one and zero. And from doing that, I looked for tag markers that are made sometimes in some modifications of PDFs called XMPs, which is Adobe's format of markup, and I did not find any evidence of those tags.
When you're trying to determine whether there's integrity in the data, are you able to tell whether or not there's been any alterations or tampering before the item is put on the Gray Key machine to make the extraction?
That would be when you're talking about if the physical device had been manipulated, is
yes.
That correct?
Yes.
I cannot tell if the physical device has been manipulated prior to it being imaged. I can only validate if the image was correct. In theory, all of the data of anything that you did on that device would still show in the evidence of device logs and whatever locations that were touched or communicated with. But at that point, it's the same as any user interacting with the device itself.
After the phone's extracted, or at the time it's extracted, does it have the history of the device on that extraction?
Could you rephrase?
Yes. At the time the phone is extracted and the copy is made in the PDF and the digital copy, does the digital copy and the PDF contain the history of searches and calls and other items on that phone?
The forensic image itself contains a variety of different artifacts or traces that are left behind by activities that a user does on a phone. Yes.
You use the term artifact. What does that mean in a basic sense?
An artifact is any type of evidence that is left behind on your phone of an action. So, for example, if you receive a call, there are multiple places in the phone that show that a call was received. That can be in the call log, that could be in a notification, that could be in a unified log that tracks the activity that the phone's doing. There's multiple locations, and each one of those residue of the fact that the call came in, that's what I would refer to as an artifact. So you could have an artifact not just about a call, about a web search, about taking a photo, any action you take on your phone may create an artifact.
Before we get into those two questions about any alleged deletions from Safari, a Google search or an internet search, and any alleged deletions of phone calls, I want to start with your explanation or your sharing how the timestamp works relative to that search beginning at 2:27 a.m. on January 29th, 2022.
So, for clarity, there's more than one search that happens actually at 2:27. There is some activity that's looking at, and I don't want to mispronounce this the name of the town, I'll try Hockomock Sports, looking at activities for the sporting events at that school system, I assume, or county location. There is a timestamp for the search How's Long to Die in Cold. However, that timestamp isn't about active searches. It's about the time that a tab was either opened or moved to the background. So How's Long to Die in Cold is the most current search in the tab that you opened at that was opened at 2:27. So if you're using your phone and you go to your browser, you have some choices. You can just open an existing tab or you can open a new tab. A new tab was opened at 2:27 a.m., and that search was done there. Another tab, actually at 2:27, was moved to the background, and its last search at the time it was moved to the background was I believe it's Raining Men, the YouTube video. So those two searches both exist as what's called browser state searches, but that browser state isn't about the time that it was searched. It's about the time that the browser tab that you opened either went to the background, or if it's never been moved to the background, the current search. So the time, in the instance of the It's Raining Men video, is the time that that video was moved to the background and the new tab took over as the tab that's active. And that tab, the last search done in that tab, is How's Long to Die in the Cold, because that database holds the current search, it constantly gets updated, and the time that the tab was either opened, if it's the first time it's opened, or moved to the background, if it's an existing tab.
Did you put together an exhibit that would help explain some of the different databases?
I did put it together an exhibit that would show that.
May I approach?
Yes.
Handing you a piece of paper, do you recognize that?
I do. This is table one from the first report I created on this case on the phone that I was told was for Jen McCain.
Is that the thing that will help you explain?
It will.
I move this to evidence.
Could you approach Jen?
Okay.
Or I'm going to object if you want.
You can call now.
Before we look at any chalk, I want you to explain the entire basis for that chalk and your ultimate opinions that are reflected in the chalk. So let's start from the beginning.
May I look at my copy of the chart, or no?
Why don't I just ask you?
See if you can answer the questions and if you can let us know.
Yes, Your Honor.
When you looked at the phone to analyze it, were you trying to determine when a particular search was made, specifically the search How's Long to Die in Cold?
Correct. I was looking for two searches, both How Long to Die in CIKD and How's Long to Die in Cold.
So as a forensic examiner, how do you begin the process to try to identify and determine when that search is actually made?
So the first thing we would want to identify is what application was being used at the time to make the search. So looking at that date time stamp, it was able to, on that date, be able to determine that Safari was the application that was being used as the Google browser. And then you would begin looking at the artifacts for Safari, both those that are parsed by the forensics tools, but then further looking into the data structures that hold that data itself, and then ultimately conducting testing to determine why a certain artifact exists.
So you mentioned you begin, the beginning step is the forensic tool or tools. Did you use forensic tools to get information or parse any data regarding this potential search at 227?
Yes, I use multiple forensics tools.
Can you share with us the multiple forensic tools that you used?
Absolutely. I used Cellebrite Physical Analyzer. I used Magnet Axiom. I used just the tools I used at first. I used iLeap. There are further tools I used later, but those were the three that I started with.
What tools did you use later?
Later, I used specifically, Sanderson's Forensics Toolkit, the forensics browser in Sanderson's Forensics Toolkit, which helps exploit SQLite databases. And then I further reviewed in a tool called Rabbit Hole.
To begin with, Cellebrite, is that a tool that you're familiar with?
Yes.
Is it a commonly used tool in the industry?
Yes, commonly used mobile forensics tool.
Is it reputable?
Highly reputable.
Why did you use Cellebrite?
I use Cellebrite because on any mobile exam, I'm going to validate what is captured by Cellebrite and Magnet Axiom because they have the most robust parsing of what is in my tool arsenal. And then I would also follow up with iLeap closely behind because iLeap has a lot of artifacts that aren't supported by either of those tools. Using a variety of tools is going to give you different coverage, and each tool has a different perspective on how they view and display data.
You said you also use Magnet Axiom?
That is correct.
Is that a leading forensic tool as well?
Yes, that is also a leading forensics tool.
Are you familiar with that company?
I'm very familiar with Magnet Forensics. I was actually their director of forensics for 5 years, then continued to consult for them for an additional 2 years under my company, Hexordia, and my company continues to be a reseller of Magnet's products.
You mentioned different tools may present information a different way. Do those tools change the underlying data at all?
That's a great question. So when we're talking about the results that a tool shows, the tools maintain the integrity of that original forensic image. And that's actually something we verify as we continue through our exams to make sure that the underlying data hasn't been changed. There are some tools. I did use some other tools. I apologize. I also used Artex and Mushy. But the, Artex is capital A, lowercase RT, capital E, lowercase X, and then Mushy is M-U-S-H-Y. Oh, you're welcome. I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? I got this, the spelling threw me off.
I asked you about using multiple tools and whether or not the use of different tools changes the actual underlying data.
So the actual underlying data is always maintained, and we do validate that. Some tools allow you to see parsed results and then allow you to dig deeper into looking at the actual files and data structures. Those would be tools like Cellebrite, Physical Analyzer, and Magnet Axiom. Some tools show you the parsed results and tell you where they got them, like iLeap. It shows you the parsed results and tells you the file location, and then you would open that up in an external tool. And then some of the tools I used are not tools that parse the results, but are tools that allow me to manually look at the data structures. So they directly allow me to look at the data structures. And all of the tools I use in this instance are tools that do not change the underlying data.
Is it important or critical to go beyond the tools presentations and actually analyze the data yourself?
It is absolutely critical. Actually, in the NIST Scientific Foundation's paper from the National Institute of Science and Technology that states the foundations of digital forensic science, it states that it is the examiner's duty to not only verify and validate tool results, but also to provide meaning to forensics parsed results.
Does software update regularly?
Oh, the software updates all the time. Typically, we get an update about once a month, and to be honest, it's not enough to keep up with how many new apps are developed and how many new phones come out and how many of your applications get updates, new features, for example, maybe in Instagram or Facebook. So the tools update very, very regularly.
When you use the Cellebrite tool to analyze the 227 search, did the search How Long to Die in the Cold have a timestamp on it?
There are actually multiple artifacts for How Long to Die in Cold. Remember earlier we defined an artifact and we spoke about it was one of the types of traces. So there are multiple traces for that How Long to Die in Cold. Only one of them is associated with the 227 timestamp, but there are other instances of evidence of that was parsed by Cellebrite.
Is there any danger for an untrained eye to rely simply on the software when looking at a search like this, How Long to Die in the Cold, and seeing the 227 timestamp?
Absolutely. There's a really scary danger that an examiner who has not dug into the artifact and tested to see what it means may assume erroneously that 227 timestamp is the time that what is there is searched. The search in that field of that artifact is going to always be the most recent search in the tab, but that timestamp actually means either the time that that tab was backgrounded or, if it's the first time the tab's been opened, when it was opened. So you could erroneously implicate a search was done hours or some time period or even days before it actually occurred. Some of us leave our tabs open forever.
In your teaching, examiners and students, do you teach about this specific concern and concept?
Yes. I teach about this concern both in my mobile forensic analysis class, my mobile forensics course that I teach at George Mason University in their digital forensics master's program, and in the data structures course where we specifically learn how to analyze these databases in question.
In your experience, how common does an untrained examiner make this mistake?
I wouldn't be able to speak to how common an untrained examiner does it, but regularly my students get those questions wrong on earlier examples I give them in class to kind of indicate to them that they could easily make mistakes without understanding meaning, and I use it as a teaching aid. So teaching, you know, 90, 100 easy students a year, I regularly see that in untrained examiners that I'm teaching in my class, but I wouldn't be able to say that across the discipline.
You mentioned that Cellebrite showed the search on the report as How's Long to Die in the Cold with a timestamp of 227. Is it 227:40?
Yes, that's correct.
Do you know whether or not Cellebrite has updated its software?
In May, Cellebrite of last year, Cellebrite made an update to their software actually to remove this artifact because of its ambiguity and the risk that an examiner may overstate or misstate what it is.
Is this ambiguity reflected in other types of software?
Could you rephrase, please?
Sure. For example, when you did a report in Axiom, did it have similar reflection in the report?
Objection, Your Honor.
Ask it differently.
Did you run a report regarding this time frame through Axiom software?
I did process the image through Axiom, yes.
When you did that, was it the same or a different result?
Axiom and Cellebrite really show their data very, very differently. So Cellebrite takes a perspective of alerting people to possible deletions by annotating either a question mark or a red X next to artifacts that come from different areas. Magnet instead marks if the artifact was parsed or carved. I feel like now I need to explain to you parsed or carved. So parsed means that the data was where it was expected to be found, and the algorithm was able to cleanly see that this is there. Carve means that it had to run that algorithm against the data structure as a whole and found it as a partial result. So it carved it out, went and found it, instead of it just sitting there exactly where it was expected to be, and shows you both the results. So it'll show all of the results of, in this instance, the sessions, tab sessions, but the data browser DB, the tab state, it's going to, instead of telling you this has a red X, it'll instead say it was carved. So it's a different presentation of the same data.
And so I want to talk about deletions in a little bit, but I want to get back to the 227 search.
Sure.
So when you produced or you looked at the report for Cellebrite and it showed this timestamp as well as the phrase, how's long to die in the cold, where did you look? How did you make an analysis to determine whether or not that search was actually made at 227 or another time? What was your next steps for us?
So in looking at that timestamp, the first thing I did was actually go and look at what literature exists on the artifact, if anybody had reviewed this artifact before. I also created my own data set and tested how we could get what that timestamp means. So if I make a search in a tab, and then I make another search in a tab, which timestamp is it? If I make a search in a tab and then open a different tab, what changes? I also looked at the documentation in the artifact reference guide for Axiom, which does state, it describes that timestamp as the time in which the tab is backgrounded, and it gives a stipulation that in certain circumstances, the timestamp can be earlier than the search.
Did you specifically look in any databases or for artifacts in the data to help make an analysis of when the search happened?
Of when the search happened as a whole? Absolutely. So there are multiple databases that I looked at that show search information for Safari. So I looked at the plist, mobile Safari plist. I looked at the browser state database. I looked for the history database. I also looked at the Knowledge CDB. The Knowledge CDB is a little bit different. That isn't a database for Safari. It's a database for all of Apple, so it can predict your behavior. So it takes in information that Apple wants to take in, including browser history, and it saves that information so it can make predictive information. I also looked at the caches in the Safari, which is the things that Safari is trying to make quick reference to. This would include suggested terms for commonly searched items.
When a URL or a search through Safari is typed in, or if it connects, does it leave a trace in different parts of the computer or the phone?
Yeah, so when you actually do any search, you're going to leave traces. Now, it does depend if you are in private browsing or non-private browsing. So non-private browsing is what most of us use regularly. Private browsing might be what you elect to use. Well, some people would elect to use it if they're doing searches they wouldn't want their spouse to see, like maybe they're looking at porn, or maybe you're doing something secure like looking at your banking information. You may intentionally use a private browser. For Google users, this would be the equivalent of incognito in Google Chrome, and you may intentionally use that. And so the artifacts for that are more limited than the artifacts for non-private searches. So some of these artifacts only exist for non-private searches, and some exist for private searches.
And in this case, this phone, was it on non-private or private?
So specifically the two searches we're talking about, how long to die in cold and how long to die in CIKLD, excuse my differentiation there. Both of those searches were done in non-private browsing.
So they weren't hidden?
I don't understand the question, yeah.
Okay. Was there any applications on to mask those searches?
Not to the best of my knowledge. I did not see any.
We began with the 227.40 timestamp. The next recording on that tab, do you recall what time that was?
I believe the next, and I'm trying to remember the chart from memory, mm-hmm. if that's correct. So I believe the next thing we're looking at is the 623 suggestion from Apple search terms for how long to digest food. Am I matching what you're seeing on your chart?
Well, let me ask you.
Okay.
When you saw that, do you look on the same tab or a database? Where did you find that information?
Fair. Understood. So all of those databases I was just mentioning before, we're looking at all the parsed results from all of those, and I was looking in the entirety of the scope from the time of midnight till noon. That was the time frame of my scope, of all of the content that was done in the tabs, the tabs for browser state DB, cloud tabs artifacts, history DB, mobile Safari plist, knowledge C, each one of those. And then I was combining them to timeline out the activity.
At 6:23:51, did you look into how long TIDIE in CIKD?
So that would be the next thing that we see after the Apple suggested term of how long to digest food. That's the next thing we see, is we see an entry of that. There's two immediately next to each other. I don't remember the precision on the seconds of which one's first off the top of my head, but one is in Knowledge C and one is in the Mobile Safari playlist.
Can they appear in different rooms in the data bank, in different places, the same search?
Searches appear in many different places. They can leave traces, such as that Knowledge CDB. I love that Apple calls that knowledge. It's like what it's trying to learn. So the Knowledge CDB, what Apple's trying to learn about you, as well as in that Mobile Safari plist, as well as at the moment of that search, which I don't have the device in that moment, but just so there's an understanding, that open tab, the URL would have been updated, or URL is the website, would have been updated to that search at that moment. Had we imaged it at that moment, it would have been how long to die in CIKD.
And finally, at 6:24:47, did you identify any artifacts with that search that appears at, with the timestamp of 2:27:40? Did you find the same?
Correct. At 6:24, we have two timestamps in the same two locations for how long to die in cold, the Knowledge C and the Mobile Safari plist.
So based on your analysis in that issue, did you come to an opinion whether or not the phrase "how's long to die in cold" was actually searched at 2:27 a.m. on January 29, 2022?
There are no artifacts.
So the answer is yes or no.
Can you repeat the question,
yes,
please?
And so based on your analysis of the phone and the data using all of those softwares, did you come to an opinion whether or not the phrase "how's long to die in cold" was searched at that timestamp tab of 2:27:40?
Yes, I came to an opinion.
And what is your opinion?
Objection, Your Honor.
Rephrase the question as to the opinion.
I'm sorry?
I'll see you inside, Officer Mr. Lessing.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You've explained to us the analysis you engaged in and the process you engaged in. In forensic data analysis, is there a methodology that you use, not just looking at the printout of the programs, a methodology you use that is accepted in the industry for experts to analyze this data and come to your opinion?
Absolutely. Beyond looking at what was in the tool results, I further looked at those databases independently and conducted testing of the artifacts.
And in addition to what you did, can you share with us how and why this methodology is accepted in your practice as forensic analyst?
This methodology is accepted by NIST. And by organizations like the Scientific Working Group of Digital Evidence. I'm intimately familiar as both a member of the Scientific Working Group on Digital Evidence, who helps work towards the building and development of these consensus-based documents of procedures to be followed in digital forensics analysis, and as a member of the National Institute of Science and Technology, NIST, Organizational Scientific Area Committees, OSAC, Digital Evidence Subcommittee. Where we also produce guidelines such as the data set guidelines for generation of the guidelines for data set generation, which is how you do your actual testing and creation of data sets. And I was also a part of the subcommittee that drafted that. So I'm intimately familiar with the accepted policies and procedures because I am also a member of the groups that help author these, as well as review them and look and use them.
Are there articles and guidance in the industry about this particular practice of analysis?
For analysis, just for clarification, you're talking about for analysis of Safari artifacts, of mobile forensics, of browser state DB, just for clarity on the question?
Let's work our way through it. How about through Safari?
For Safari, there are multiple different blogs that talk about Safari, as well as I have analysis of Safari through classes I took, such as SANS 4508, which is their, 518, SANS 4518, which is the Mac and iOS analysis course, which I took.
How about the specific guidance regarding searching the different databases for artifacts?
In terms of methodology for digging into databases,
yes.
Is that correct? There are multiple, I've taken courses throughout my master's program, courses on how to analyze digital forensics artifacts, including mobile device forensics, throughout my GIAC certifications. I've taken multiple instructor-led courses on how to do these, as well specifically that cover mobile safari history in mobile forensics at GMU in his master's program as part of the SANS 4518 class. And in terms of data structures, I've taken study on how to analyze databases like SQLite and PLIS are covered in those courses.
There are books on study on this methodology?
There are multiple books on digital forensics, many of which I've read, and including books specifically on analysis of SQLite databases, such as Sanderson's SQLite Forensics, which is probably the most authoritative because not only was it written by Sanderson, who makes a tool, it was tech edited by three renowned forensics examiners, as well as Dr. Richard Hipp, who created SQLite itself.
The methodology, the technique you mm-hmm. use to look past the reports and actually look at the data to make your determination and provide your arrive at your opinions, is that methodology regularly accepted within the forensic data community?
Absolutely. Again, using the methodology from the consensus-based documents from the community, from the scientific working group digital evidence on best practices for analysis, as well as specifically for the SQLite databases I was looking at. I do that deeply verifying and in accordance with the understandings from Sanderson's book.
Now, you share with us that you had an opinion regarding the timestamp and whether that it was applicable to the search term, "How's Long to Die in Cold."
That is correct.
Now, I want to ask you, to a reasonable degree of forensic data, scientific certainty, what is your opinion about whether the phrase "how's long to die in cold" was made at the time of the timestamp 2:27:40.
It's the last time, Mr. Nelson, on this issue, okay? All right, go right ahead, Mr. Brennan.
I'm now going to ask you for your first opinion. So you shared that you have an opinion about whether that timestamp 2:27:40 was, whether or not that was the time the search "How's Long to Die in the Cold" occurred. Can you tell us, to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, your opinion about whether that search, "How's Long to Die in the Cold," occurred at 2:27:40 a.m. on January 29th, 2022.
Same
objection, Your Honor.
Okay. The objections are ruled.
What I can state to a scientific degree of certainty is that that search occurred at 6:24 a.m. and was the last search in the tab that had been opened at 2:27.
Do you have an opinion to a degree of scientific certainty whether there was any other searches similar to "How's Long to Die in the Cold" that evening on that tab?
Objection, Your Honor.
I'm going to allow it.
May I first inquire, you meant morning,
I'm sorry, that morning, yes.
Just clarifying, I did not look at evening searches. Can you repeat? I apologize. I disrupted
sure.
my own train
you
of thought.
You have an opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty whether there were any other searches on that tab before the final search at 6:24:47, "How's Long to Die in Cold."
Same objection, Your Honor.
Overruled.
Just ensuring that I have the question correct.
Please.
You're asking if what else occurred in that tab prior?
Yes.
That I cannot say with a clear degree of certainty.
Okay. Did you develop a chalk that I showed
I did.
You earlier?
Yes.
Like to approach?
Yes.
Again, I show you. the same document. You recognize it?
Yes.
What is it?
It is the exhibit that I created that was labeled Table 1 in the first report I had delivered.
And does that provide information that will assist us in understanding your opinion?
Yes.
I'd move, subject to redaction, that this be introduced into evidence.
Your Honor, I have no issue with regard to the redaction aspect, but consistent with my prior objections, I would object to that.
Okay, I'm going to allow this into evidence. Your rights are safe, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Exhibit 82.
Madam Clerk, 82?
Exhibit 82.
Thank you. With the court's permission, I'd like to show Exhibit 82 to the jury.
Okay.
Could we enlarge the first two? And we're going to need to get the right column in if we can, please. Thank you. Ms. High, can you see it from there?
I can. Thank you.
If you can walk us through how this exhibit assists us in understanding your explanation and the basis for your opinion.
This exhibit shows the Safari artifacts on artifacts of Google searches in Safari related to the two searches in question, How Long to Die in CILKD and How Long to Die in Cold, that occurred on the morning of November 29th, 2022, on the device under examination.
If I look at this chart and I see in the top left, it says 2:27:40 a.m. And then under the search term, it says How Long to Die in Cold. How do I understand your opinion that that search didn't happen at 2:27:40?
This document is showing you the data that is the parsed result. The source of that artifact that you see in the last column, it's a little bit cut off, the browser state db-wall file, that database does store, how the data is stored, the search term, How Long to Die in Cold, with an associated MAC Absolute Epoch timestamp that translates to 2:27 a.m., that is what is physically stored. That does not annotate the meaning of that artifact. That was determined through testing following the NIST-OSAC data generation guidelines for testing.
In the second row, we see a timestamp on the left-hand column, 6:23:49. And it provides artifact, the cache record.
Mm-hmm.
What is the term, and what does that mean under the search term?
iOS Safari cache records. A cache refers to something that a computer program wants quick and easy access to. When we search on our phones, anything, a lot of times, be it in Google or in Safari, depending on what type of phone you own, it'll suggest what it thinks you're going to type in, right? So you can click it. It's trying to be helpful. In this instance, at 6:23:49, we have a cache record that indicates that Apple suggested the phrase, how long does it take to digest food?
And then under that, 6:23:51, it appears it says a recent web search, and the spelling has changed. How long, TIDIEINCIKD.
So this, in reference to these two search terms, this is the first actual search that occurs at 6:23:51 a.m. Upon beginning the typing of that phrase, Apple provided the suggested search, and the person inputting into the phone at that time continued to type out a phrase and finished it as how long, TIDIENCIKD. Which that is available to us in the Mobile Safari plist, which tracks recent web searches. And then we'll see 6 seconds later, we get that reference in that Knowledge C database that I mentioned before. That's the next line. So that's the Knowledge C database is Apple's way of keeping knowledge about what the user's doing. It sees and holds your knowledge. It's an easy way to remember it. That's why I teach my students. So that Knowledge CDB tracks a lot of things for predictive purposes. And so 6 seconds later, it's logging that same search. So that search is being tracked in two places.
And so one search can be left as artifacts in different locations on the database?
Correct. There can be multiple traces or artifacts of the same user action in different places on a mobile device.
And if we go down to the bottom, the last column, at 6:24:47, we again see house long to die in cold. And if you look in the first column, it's the same phrase. Is that a coincidence that it appears at the bottom at 6:24:47 and also appears up at 2:27:40?
As mentioned before, through testing of the artifact for Browser State DB, that artifact will hold the most recent search that happened in the tab. So it is logical that HOS long to die in cold was searched at 6:24:18, tracked in that mobile Safari plist, repeated in Knowledge C, Knowledge made its tracking in Knowledge C DB, and then that table for Browser State DB, which again has the time that the tab was opened, or the last time it was backgrounded, and updated just the website that was visited. So the website, that is why we get that 227 time. That's actually, as far as the data storage is, the first thing I have in there, because I want to put it in chronological time order for exhibit purposes, is actually the last thing to happen, because it's the update to what's in the tab.
And you offered that the how long to die in cold is the last thing to happen. Do you have an opinion to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty the time when that search was made?
Objection, Your Honor.
To a reasonable degree of certainty, I can say that how long to die in cold was searched at approximately 6:24 a.m.
Now, moving on from the 227 search, there are two other issues that you were asked to analyze. We talked about them at the beginning. Let's begin with whether or not you looked at the data and analyzed the data and came to any opinions about whether that phrase, how long to die in cold, was user deleted on that device.
So there's two really key elements as to if that was user deleted. If the question is, did I come to opinion? Yes.
How you came to that, to an opinion that we'll ultimately share with the jury?
The first line in that exhibit, the ending of that, if you remember, it said browserstate.db-wall. That's important, so we'll talk about that in a second. But the first thing I want to bring up is kind of how the database works, because I didn't just look at the tool result. I extracted that database, and I did a deeper analysis on it using Sanderson's tool, because that information was in that dash wall file. So when a SQLite database, which is a specific way of storing, very, very common on mobile phones, actually one of the most common, when that database stores data, it has two versions. The most recent version and the version in use here uses what's called a write-ahead log. So before data is committed, it is written to a write-ahead log. I'll kind of explain it. So let's say we're in a restaurant and we're sitting at a table and we're ordering food. Our table is the table. Data is going to come to the table and that's going to be our food. So when we order food, let's say we've got a chicken sandwich, a burger, and a pizza coming to the table. The chicken sandwich, the burger, and the pizza, the kitchen puts it in the warming area. It's the write-ahead log. The server grabs it from there. It's where data sits before it goes to the table, just like your food goes to that serving station before your server brings it to your table. Server brings it to the table. That table's got its burger, its chicken, and its pizza. Another table orders waffles and pancakes. They think it's breakfast. The waffles and pancakes are made by the kitchen. They're put on the serving area. Waitress comes over. This pizza has pepperoni. I don't eat pepperoni. Can you send it back? Waitress picks up that pepperoni and sends it back. That's a deletion. Pepperoni pizza was just removed from the table, right? We're deleting it. We're moving. We said it's not what we wanted. The waitress is removing it. She brings it back to that serving area. At that moment, that serving area has the deleted pizza, but also the waffles and pancakes that are waiting to go out to the table. That's how a write-ahead log works. Any changes that are happening sit in the write-ahead log until the database is closed, and then when it's reopened, all those changes are made, both additions and deletions. So often when a phone is imaged, when we make a forensic image, the applications are still open, so we have those wall files. When we look in our Safari browser, the database knows to read it to you in its current state, so it tells you where the waffles and pancakes are going. They're going to that table, so it shows it as if it's in the table. But it's not in the table yet. So if when we parse the data and we look at the restaurant and we don't look at the back kitchen, we would only at that time see the chicken and the burger, right? Pizza got sent back, waffles and pancakes haven't come out yet. So when we get the data, we get two files. We get the restaurant, that's the database, and we get the serving area, that's the wall file. Just because it's in the wall file does not mean it's deleted. It means that that record wasn't where it naturally sits yet. It could be. That wall file can contain deleteds and food or data that hasn't yet been delivered to the database. So the wall file consists of both. So an assumption that the data was deleted just because it's in the wall file is actually not true. And the peer review paper I mentioned earlier that I had accepted in Forensic Science International actually has a section that explains this exact presence for SQLite databases about how we refer to that as recovered and not deleted. Actually, through that entire document, we don't use the phrase deleted. We refer to things in statement of recovery because we need to determine why it's there. So we can't say that it's deleted just because it came from the wall file. Some tools will automatically indicate to the examiner that they need to dig deeper into that. I did do further analysis by looking at the wall file. That particular item is a little bit more complex, actually exists on multiple pages because it moves as...
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.